This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, I'm Chua Entik. You're listening to Human Rights Defenders, an eight-part series with the Human Rights Commission of Malaysia, better known as Suhakam. Every Tuesday, I speak to the eight appointed commissioners about their work, find out why they are passionate about human rights, and the issues that they will pursue during their three-year terms. This week, Datuk Ma Wing Kwai. Datuk Ma served in the civil service as a prosecutor and then as a magistrate and sessions court judge for 12 years before going into private practice. He was appointed as a judicial commissioner and then a judge of the High Court of Malaya in Kuala Lumpur. In 2012, he was elevated to the Court of Appeal. He tells me why he joined Suhakam last year after retiring from the judiciary in 2015.
The issue of human rights is very much related to rule of law. And personally, I have been a lawyer for many, many years. And having retired as a judge in the Court of Appeal, I find that the issue of human rights is really an extension of the jurisprudential concept of the rule of law. And on being appointed, I feel that I can contribute towards upholding and enhancing human rights from within the system, and try to correct some of the shortcomings rather than just being an armchair critic from outside.
What are these shortcomings?
Well, many a time you have heard people say that Suhakam is a toothless bulldog or a paper tiger. We have the Suhakam Act, which gives us our mandate, but basically, they say that we do not have the bite and we don't have the enforcement. That is true. We don't have the enforcement powers. But in our portfolio, the main concern really is to keep on creating awareness in the public and the powers that be, mainly government officials, members of parliament, and people in the public domain. And the idea is to ensure that they are fully conversant with the various rules of human rights, and so that this becomes second nature to them when they are dealing in their performing their duties.
So you mentioned that your career was in law. How would you define what the rule of law is?
Basically, I would say that rule of law to a layperson would mean fairness and reasonableness within the norms of civil society, and that a person ought not to be punished or condemned for something without being heard. I think the right to be heard and to have an explanation is very important. And in the Malaysian context, the rule of law here would mean compliance with civil society norms, cultural and traditional practices, and respect for the written law.
Cultural and traditional practices, is that circular as well?
Well, for human rights, again, you will hear many people say, at least those who are not subscribers to the concept of human rights, they will say, human rights is a Western concept, and we in Malaysia should not be aping the West and just follow blindly. Well, there are two ways of looking at it. Number one, human rights concepts are not Western concepts. They are not white men's concepts. These are universal norms and universal precepts, universal rules. And for us, it also applies to Malaysia. But importantly, we will have to look at these principles from a Malaysian context, from the racial context, religious context, and to ensure that it gels with the civil liberties, that gels with the civil expectations in society. So it is a set of principles which we try to Malayanize. But a lot of it is it's definitely not aping the West.
You served for, I think, almost 30 years in the judicial and legal services before setting up your own private practice. Did you always know that you were going to go into public service?
Well, Ingrid, I was called to the bar a long time ago, 1971, to the English bar and to the Malaysian bar in 1972. And after a year in private practice, I joined the Judicial and Legal Service. And I was in service for a good 12 years before coming out to practice again. And I was practicing at a bar for 25 years before being invited to join the bench in 2010. Yes, I've always felt a calling for the law. And to me, the legal profession was something I wanted to do from as early as Form 5, Form 6.
How did you know so early that you wanted to go into law?
Because I felt that a sense of lack of justice in the community, even in those early days, where you would be in a position to know what is right, what is wrong, and some of the things that were going on in society, which you have a different view. And I thought that law would be a good training ground to be able to know the differences and see what really is right and what really is wrong. I think the 1969 racial riots that we had in Malaysia as a result of racial differences and intolerance, that was a eye-opener for me. Although I had already started law by then, it was an eye-opener in the sense that all this was the result of social differences. And some perceived it as racial differences, and perhaps prejudices and so on. So without being political about it, through law, one would be able to understand what the laws provide and what can and cannot be done within the norms of society.
I need to correct what I said earlier, because you served in the civil service as a prosecutor, magistrate and session judge for 12 years before you went into private practice for 25 years.
Yes,
that's before your appointment as the judge to the Court of Appeal.
Well, when I was in the judicial and legal service, that's very much part of the civil service. So I was a civil servant. And for 12 years, I was very lucky to be posted to various positions. I started off as a magistrate and then as a president of the Sessions Court and Registrar of the High Court. That was all in the judicial service. And then in the legal service, I acted as a deputy public prosecutor, senior federal counsel in the civil division, and my last posting was as senior assistant parliamentary draftsman. That is drafting the laws and dotting the I's and crossing the T's. A very boring job, actually, but important.
So you've experienced all aspects of how law is implemented, drafted and executed in this country?
Yes, I have been very fortunate to have been posted all around. I've known of colleagues who have spent the entire career just sitting on a bench or long periods just as a prosecutor. But having been posted to various posts, this gave me an all-round exposure, all-round training. And, well, it's always helped me in good stead. Even after I left service and practiced for 25 years, it's been very useful. And I was not a scholar, so there was no bond, but I voluntarily joined the service to have an idea of how the other half of the legal world lives in Malaysia. You can always go back to practice, but you can't always want to just join the judicial and legal service. So when the opportunity arose, I took it. And I gave myself 5 years, but I liked the job so much, it went on to 12. And then after that, I resigned. And after 25 years, I was invited by the former Chief Justice, Tun Zaki Azmi, together with a few other practitioners, senior practitioners, to join the service, firstly as a judicial commissioner in the High Court. Our task was to try to help clear the backlog, especially of civil and commercial cases, because in 2010, we were experiencing long delays in cases. So I think we acquitted ourselves quite well in clearing the backlog.
Was there a reason for why there is a huge backlog?
Simply because all the usual reasons would be frequent requests for postponements by lawyers, judges not sitting long enough to deal with cases. It was not unknown, or not uncommon, rather, to have judges not sit in the afternoons at all. And the complaint then was that judges would be off on the golf course by 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So all that has stopped. And because KPI was introduced in 2010, we also introduced the new concept of new commercial courts and new civil courts. where it simply meant that the existing judges would clear the old cases, whereas a batch of new judges would handle cases that were registered from 2010 onwards. So that this made a big difference. And so just keep on adding to the old numbers, we had a different group of judges handling the current cases. And I think after a few years, yes, the objective was achieved. And I think we can all say now that there's no further backlog. In fact, if you go to court today, you have a civil case, your case will can be heard and disposed of between 9 to 12 months. And an appeal to the Court of Appeal would take also about the same time. So gone are the days where people had to wait 10 years, 20 years for a case to be dealt with.
I want to spend some time a little bit on this idea of the independence of the judiciary. The recent appointments of additional judges, I think, has a lot of commentators asking whether or not the repeat of this judicial crisis might happen. And you've said in the past that as a retired judge, you would not go back into court and present a case in front of your former colleagues because you think it's important that perception of the judiciary as independence is just as important as the actual independence. Would you have a comment on that?
Yes. I think the independence of the judiciary is very important. And to me, it simply means the judges must be independent in thought and in action. Not just say what they think independence is, but it must be reflected in their judgments. And this is what I call intellectual honesty. Because life is not always black and white. There's a lot of grey. And even in a grey area, there are many shades of grey. And it's always a question of interpretation. So it really depends a lot on a judge's integrity, of course, the knowledge of the law as well, to be able to see what is right and what is wrong, what is fair and reasonable. And of course, without having to say it, judges must be absolutely incorruptible. There's absolutely no room for corruption within the system. Because the moment you have that, it's all tainted. You lose public confidence. And no matter how clever a judge is, the public just won't have trust and confidence in what he says. And the whole system of judiciary and law and order in this country, or in any country for that matter, must be a sense of confidence in the system.
I'm speaking today to Suakam Commissioner Datuk Ma Wing Kwai. After the break, I'll ask Datuk Ma whether we've made any progress 8 years after the death of Teo Beng Hock. He was one among three justices who heard the case. BFM 89.9. This is Human Rights Defenders, a series of conversations with Suakam commissioners. My guest today is Datuk Ma Wing Kwai, who was appointed to the commission in 2016 through a three-year term. As a judge, you've written a few landmark judgments, and you said you're especially proud of three in particular. Each of these, I think, is related to the work that you do now in terms of a human rights commissioner advocating on abolition of preventive detention law, upholding of rule of law, and the ending of torture and custody. Maybe we can start with the Teo Beng Hock case. We just passed the 8th anniversary of Teo Beng Hock's death. Have we made any progress on custodial death since 2008?
Okay, let me deal with the Teo Beng Hock case briefly and the effect of that judgment. Well, I think the facts are quite well noted in that Teo Beng Hock was found dead on a fifth-floor podium, having fallen out from the MACC office on the 14th floor of the building in Shah Alam, I believe it was called Masalam Building. And the whole question of whether he had committed suicide by jumping out himself or someone was responsible for it. After his death, an inquest was held in the coroner's court, and the magistrate returned a verdict of open verdict, meaning to say, you just don't know what happened. Open, can be open for further query, but at that moment, you just don't know what happened, which is quite different from the medical cause of death. The medical cause of death was multiple injuries, multiple fractures, that we know. But the legal cause of death was open. So that went up on appeal. The family of Teo Beng Hock appealed to the High Court, and the High Court judge upheld that verdict of open verdict. At the same time, or rather soon thereafter, there was a Royal Commission of Inquiry, if you recall, and the commission returned a strange verdict to my mind, which was driven to suicide. They didn't really say that he jumped out and committed suicide, as one would expect him. You know, if you really jump out a window, then you want to kill yourself. But it was like somebody was responsible for that. It was driven to suicide. Then the case from the High Court came up on appeal to the Court of Appeal. And I was sitting on that panel with my colleagues, Justice Arif and Justice Hamid Sultan. And the three of us came to the same conclusion, was slightly different reasoning. And because of the importance of the case and because of the public interest that was involved, each of us wrote a separate written judgment, which is not the norm, because usually in a court of appeal, you have a unanimous decision. You have just one written judgment when there's an appeal. So each of us wrote a separate written judgment. And each of us decided that the open verdict was not correct. We set it aside. And we returned a verdict of death caused by person or persons unknown. So we say that somebody was responsible for his death. And it was definitely not suicide. It was not misadventure. And we say it is not open. Importantly, what we set out to explain as a matter of law was that we changed the test for the standard of proof in an inquest. Previously, the coroner or the magistrate would always rely on a test of beyond reasonable doubt to arrive at a verdict, which means to say it was treated almost like a criminal trial, that a person will be proven guilty beyond reasonable doubt. And that was the same test that was applied in the inquest. But when we heard this case and after reviewing the law on inquest, both here and in common law and so on, we held that the proper test is on a balance of probabilities, which is the test that you would apply to civil cases. So as long as there's some evidence to show that on a balance of probabilities something happened, that would be sufficient to arrive at a verdict. You don't have to prove it beyond reasonable doubt. And also because this is an inquiry, it's not a trial. No one was on trial. So that was a very important restatement of the law. And because the Court of Appeal was the final court in this case, the matter could not have been appealed to the federal court. So until another court disagrees with us, this is the law that has been set out. So in Teo Beng Hock's case, importantly, what was relied on by the court was, of course, the medical evidence, the evidence of the pathologists. You recall there were several pathologists called by the Attorney General's Chambers, and there was also this pathologist from Thailand, Dr. Pontip, and she had been called by the family of the deceased. And she importantly recognized or noted that there was a bruising under the skin at the neck. And she said that there must have been some force applied to the neck. And this resulted in an exhumation of the body. And there was a second post-mortem. And when they actually did the dissection and so on, they found that there was bleeding under the skin and then at the neck. And the pathologists all agreed that this was caused by trauma, a blunt force. So obviously a blunt force such as a chokehold on her neck would have caused this. And when Teo Beng Hock fell out of the window, all the doctors said that he was either semi-conscious or unconscious. So something must have happened to him on the 14th floor before he fell. So that really rules out the verdict of suicide, because you don't just fall out a window if you're unconscious or semi-conscious. And the medical evidence for this was that Teo Beng Hock did not try to break his fall, which if a person is conscious, instinctively you would try to break a fall and there would be multiple fractures in your wrist and so on. He did not have that. He only had multiple fractures on his leg. So the medical evidence was the evidence that carried the day. In fact, when arriving at the verdict of death caused by person or persons unknown, in our judgments, we had actually listed out the various people from MACC who were the last people to have dealt with Teo Bing Hock.
And is anything being done on that front in terms of placing responsibility on who caused the death?
In our judgments, we had recommended the police to reopen the investigations, or at least to continue investigations to find out the real culprits. But to my knowledge, I don't think anybody has been brought to book after that.
Because custodial death continues to happen, and there have been calls to set up this thing called the Independent Police Complaints and Misconduct Commission, which was something that's been recommended since 2005. Are these issues related?
Well, the IPCMC was a request by, rather, the formation of IPCMC was a request by civil society, by the Bar Council, and by various agencies, calling for an independent commission to look into misconduct or defaults by the police authorities. There was a recommendation for the formation of this commission, but that has not materialized. And I am told that there have been, in fact, resentment and things said against the formation of the commission by the police authorities themselves. So this has not come to pass. What we have today is the EAIC, Enforcement Agencies Independent Commission, and their work covers misconduct or breaches by the police authorities, but they also look into breaches by other agencies as well.
Has anyone been, or any officers been held to responsibility for causing a death in custody?
Yes, there have been various cases where police officers have been charged for breaches resulting in death. And to quote one very recent case, is a case of S. Balamurugan, the person who died in police custody in Klang Utara. After his death, both Sohakam and EIC conducted his own inquiry. We in Sohakam conducted an inquiry by interviewing the various police officers, the pathologists, and so on and so on. And we came to the conclusion that he died, Balamurugan died, through lack of medical attention given in good time. He was not well, and he should have been sent for treatment. And there was evidence of assault and so on. And I think EIC, they held an open inquiry, and that was completed not so long ago. And I think they came to a similar conclusion.
So what is the role of Sohakam and maybe a commissioner in a situation like this? Do you assist with the investigation process?
Yes. In Bala's case, I actually went with our staff and a few other commissioners to the police lockup. We visited the site. We spoke to the officers to have a quick idea of what actually happened. And after that, we had a proper inquiry where statements were recorded from the various witnesses. The idea, of course, is to find out what actually happened. And if we do find that there's specific people concerned, then recommendations will be made to that effect.
When things like this happen, it's usually caused by a breach in protocol, is it? Is that fair to say?
Yes, the police have SOPs, standard operating procedures, on what to do with people on arrest and how they should be produced before the magistrate for detention after 24 hours. They must be put into lockups, and these have to be gazetted lockups. The one in Klang was not a gazetted lockup. Bala should have been sent to the one in Shah Alam, but he was not. And there are requirements under the lockup rules that govern the timing of a person to be placed in a lockup in the evening, and he should not be brought out except for very urgent investigations. He should not be brought out before 7 in the morning. So there are rules to be followed. But problems arise when you have officers who either do not care for the law, some don't know the law, and the others are just delinquent about it. You know, they think that human life is not so important, I suppose. And this is where it's a major task in upholding human rights in this country.
Can I ask you a very basic question that I think at least me have taken it for granted and only have a very surface understanding of from movies and TV series? What is an individual right when they are taken into custody or when they are arrested? What is a cause for arrest? And when can you resist or when do you say you need a lawyer, for example?
Okay. Let's talk about arrest of a person under the ordinary criminal law and criminal procedure. Firstly, the police can arrest a person without a warrant if there's a reasonable suspicion of a commission of an offence. It has to be a serious offence.
Up to the discretion of the police officer.
Yes, because you're absolutely right, because what is a reasonable suspicion is a very subjective test at the time he makes the arrest. But of course, that is subject to review by a third party to see whether or not that was a proper exercise of discretion. So this arrest is for a what is known as a seizable offence. For example, theft. You see a theft occurring, or you see a snatch theft, or you see a robbery, or even a murder happening in your place. Obviously, there's no time to run and get a warrant from the courts. So these are all arrest cases without warrants. You don't arrest a motorist for failing to stop at a red light. You know, that's not an arrest case. That's a summons case. You just issue a guy with a summons. But if the driver does not accept the summons and gets unruly and starts abusing the police officer, that becomes an arrest case. So don't start quarreling with the police over a summons. But coming back to the serious offence, what happens then is that the police can arrest a person, and under Section 28 of the CPC, Criminal Procedure Code, the police have the powers to keep the person in remand for 24 hours, okay, maximum 24 hours. Now, during these 24 hours, the arrested person must be produced by the police before a magistrate. And a magistrate will then consider the application for a remand. So what can happen is that within 24 hours, assuming the police say, all right, this guy, yes, he was arrested, but really, there's no case against him. He can be released unconditionally. But sometimes the police will arrest the guy, but instead of further remanding him, they can release him on police bail, which means to say you sign a bond to appear before the police as and when directed.
You need a court order to extend the remand?
You don't. It's a police matter. You sign a bail bond on a book that the police keep. But you have to appear on a given date and time. If you don't, then it becomes another case, failure to uphold the bond. But coming back to the case where it's a serious case, the police cannot complete investigations within 24 hours and they want to remand you further. So that person must be produced before a magistrate within the 24 hours, and a magistrate has a power for further remand. But it will depend on the type of offence that's being alleged. If it's an offence where the punishment for that offence is less than 14 years, the magistrate can allow on an application a maximum of 4 days. And upon expiry of the 4 days, and if there's still grounds of further extension, the magistrate can extend for another 3 days. So you have, in that case, 1 plus 7, 8 days. During these 8 days, you are in police remand, police custody, no right to bail, and you don't have to be brought to court to be charged. If it's a case where the offence is more than punishable, be more than 14 years, then on production before the magistrate, the magistrate can remand up to 7 days on the first application, and for an extension, another 7 days. So you have the first 24 hours plus 7, another 7 is 15 days, without bail, without being charged. So in either case, after the 8th day and after the 15th day, respectively, the detainee must either be charged with an offence in court or be released, or released on police bail.
And throughout that time, I assume there'll be interrogations, there'll be investigations. Would the person in custody be accompanied by a lawyer?
Yes. Upon arrest, Section 28A of the CPC provides that a person must be informed of the grounds of arrest. So that's very important. You can't just pick up somebody from the road and, you know, don't tell him what's all about. He must be told what the offense is. He must also be given an opportunity to contact a member of the family or a friend to inform of the whereabouts. So meaning to say where he's being taken to. And also he must be informed that he has a right to communicate with a lawyer of his choice to inform them of his arrest. And the lawyer, of course, can then make contact with the police. I mentioned the fact that he has a right to a lawyer of his choice. So it's not just any lawyer nominated by the police. You can pick and choose your own lawyer. Then comes the very important question. Can a lawyer just come to the police station, barge into the investigation room and say, I want to see my client? Well, while the law allows the lawyer to be in contact and be informed of what's happening, the police have a discretion on when to allow that lawyer to speak to his client. It's only when they feel that there's no risk of interference, no risk of accomplices being informed, or where, you know, the investigations will not be prejudiced, then the lawyer will be allowed to speak, which usually means it's after all the investigations and after statements have been recorded.
What if the person can't afford a lawyer?
Well, we do have legal aid by the Bar Council, run by the Bar Council, and you have a lot of young voluntary lawyers who can help in urgent cases like this. We have the Legal Aid Bureau, which is run by the government, but that doesn't deal with criminal cases. We also have the Yayasan, but that too is for family and maintenance issues. But yes, the people really that attend to urgent arrest will be members of the Bar Council.
This again comes from my exposure to American pop culture. Is there any law that protects us against saying things that incriminate ourselves?
In Section 112 of the CPC, the requirement is that you have to answer all questions and to answer all questions truthfully. But when it comes to a question, the answer to which will self-incriminate, then you have a right to remain silent. In fact, that right must be told to you by the investigating officer and says, look, you must answer all questions, but you need not answer questions which would incriminate yourself. So in other words, if your answer is going to expose yourself to some further prosecution and so on, you can choose to remain quiet.
Knowing all that, why have we not been able to put a stop to custodial death then? You think, where is the along this process that we have been failing?
It all deals with, and when we talk about custodial deaths, I'm referring to police custodial deaths, because please bear in mind there are also deaths in immigration centres, most certainly in prisons.
Do you look into that as a commission?
We do. Okay. We do. Suwakam looks into all kinds of custodial deaths. But importantly, the largest number will be within the police custody. I suppose they are the frontliners. Police are the frontliners as far as common crime is concerned. And you have police officers in the length and breadth of the country. There's a very large number of police officers that we have. So I suppose control and regulation of the members itself would be an important task. While the SOPs are there and the do's and don'ts are all clearly set out, as I mentioned earlier, you'll have people who do not observe this, and they take this take the law in their own hands, literally, and try to get something from the suspects. It all comes down to trying to get information from suspects, from persons in custody, to try to break a case, try to break the guy and to break the case, so to speak, so that they can solve it as soon as possible. The good old days of police investigations will require a lot of groundwork and putting the pieces together. So the shortcut of this is you intimidate, you threaten, you bully, you beat. So much so that a person just breaks down and confesses.
Where's the line before it becomes torture, at least in our law?
Well, torture is a concept where it's not just causing pain and suffering. It can also include cruel and inhuman treatment. So, for example, deprivation of clean water in a lockup, deprivation of sanitary conditions, deprivation of sleep. While there's no physical assault, but that is tantamount to torture. By this process of coercion and undue influence and physical abuse, the officers hope to be able to get the information that they want and extract confessions from these detainees. And when things are overdone, that's where you will end up in problems like custodial debts.
So the other two judgments that you wrote that you were proud of were the one on Borders Bookshop and the one on Peaceful Assembly. Do you know every time before you set out to write the judgment that it will be a landmark and you know how it will be received?
Yes. As you know, in the Court of Appeal, a quorum consists of three judges, which is good in the sense that you have three minds addressed the same problem, and importantly is that the three judges will have a chance to discuss and debate the various issues before coming to a decision. No one is forced to come to a unanimous decision. You can most certainly have a dissenting judgment, but a majority would be a 2-1 decision. In the cases that you mentioned, in Nick Reiner's case, that's the Borders Bookshop case, I was the chair of that panel and I wrote that decision. As I said just now, that more often than not, it will be just one judgment if it is a unanimous decision. But if it is a majority decision, it is expected that the dissenting judge will write a dissenting judgment. In the other case of Nick Nasmi, we had, again, we had a panel of Justice Arif, myself, and Justice Hamid, much the same panel as in Tobing Hawk's case. We, again, arrived at the same conclusion unanimously, but because it was a case of such importance, we each wrote a separate judgment. And we came to the same conclusion, but for slightly varying reasons.
What do you hope to achieve during your term as commissioner?
In a nutshell, I think the standard of human rights in Malaysia can be really enhanced and recognized if we, if Malaysia can be a signatory to the remaining core conventions. We are a signatory to CRC. That's the Convention of Rights of the Child. We are also a signatory to CEDAW, Discrimination Against Women, and the other on Convention on Disabled Persons. But there are a whole list of other conventions. There are at least six of them that require Malaysia to seriously consider being a signatory. If we are also a signatory to all this, then I can say, well, Malaysia is well and truly on the way to full compliance with the universal principles. Can I just mention a few words about CAT? This is one convention where Suhakam is pushing very actively, very hard for the authorities to be a signatory, for the government to be a signatory. Because really anybody in their right mind would not say no to anything which is causing pain and suffering, things which are cruel or inhuman or degrading. Probably everybody's on the same page, but still there are some reservations by the authorities. And example, the death penalty. The position of Suhakam, of course, is for an abolition of the death penalty. The government, at best, is talking about a progressive abolition, starting with the abolition of death penalty for lesser drug trafficking cases. So until we reach that stage, it's going to be very difficult for the government to say, look, we now support the Convention Against Torture. Because the death penalty is regarded as cruel and inhuman treatment, especially where people are in the death row or bilik akhir for years and years before they are executed. That time is really a very inhuman period to be in. So with hopefully with development in what Suhakam is hoping for, then one day Malaysia will be a signatory to CAT. So of this whole list, not all will materialize. I'm sure it won't materialize within my lifetime. But these are issues that we can work towards. If your question was, what would I as a commissioner would like to see achieve, maybe a bit too idealistic, but yes, this is something that I will look forward to.
Would you know what the reservations are now that you're a commissioner and you have access to people in government? What are the reservations, at least to CAT?
As I mentioned, the death penalty is one. The other is that you have CAT principles are against corporal punishment. Corporal punishment at home, in schools. But we have corporal punishment, which is allowed in schools. We also have corporal punishment by the courts. And under Sharia, corporal punishment is also allowed. So these are the issues which have to be ironed out.
It comes back to what you mentioned earlier in the interview, in balancing the various stakeholders when trying to establish a rule of law. Cultural and traditional practices have to be respected. So is this an example of how maybe human rights have to be has to be negotiated in Malaysia?
Very much so.
So we might not be able to ratify for the foreseeable future because of these differences.
But ratification of various conventions can be allowed with reservations, which means to say, yes, we are a signatory, but you know, a particular country reserves certain positions. That can still be done. Maybe that's a baby step, first thing to do. But like in CAT, I suppose, while it is work in progress, as far as, say, for example, Sharia, to perhaps one day see that there will not be corporal punishment. But, well, it's difficult because, as you know, the Kelantan state has already passed a law which most certainly allows corporal punishment.
The rulings that we've written, peaceful assembly is a civil and political right, the right to read a book is a human right, and certainly the right to be treated fairly in custody is a human right. Is it a tough challenge to communicate what human rights is to a public without a case of gross injustice?
I think to a large extent, to a lay member of the public, is always something like, gee, it doesn't affect me personally, so therefore I won't care too much about it. This seems to be the average reaction of a person, of a Malaysian lay person. But then, of course, when it happens to you, you might say, my goodness, why am I being treated like this? For example, taking part in a birthday rally, many people will attend a rally and they think it is, an expression of their right to assemble and right to free speech and to listen to what others are saying and so on. All that's very good. But the moment they are arrested for some perceived breaches, then, of course, the whole question of, why am I not entitled to the law to have to be assembled peacefully? So I suppose in my judgment in Nick Nazmi's case, I try to deal with this and look at it from the constitutional point of view. Simply put, I would say this. You see, once upon a time, we had the Police Act, and the Police Act was very strict on public assemblies. You can't, unless you get a permit from the police, to assemble three or more persons. That was replaced with the Peaceful Assembly Act, and the emphasis, of course, is that it has to be a peaceful assembly, which means to say you can have an assembly of five or more persons without a permit, provided it's peaceful, which means to say you cannot be armed. There are no arms allowed in a peaceful assembly. I mean, that is a given. And you should not cause trouble, no fighting, no rioting, and so on. And you can assemble without a permit. So today, anyone can actually get together and try to express your common view. Assembly of five or more people, and you will not be in breach of the law. That's Section 9.1. It says that. But Section 9.1 of the Act also says that an organizer of an assembly has to give notice to the police of the venue, the place, the time, and so on, 10 days before the assembly. And if you don't, it is an offence and carries a criminal sanction. So this whole case of Nick Nazmi that came up before our panel was whether or not Section 9.1 and Section 9.5 are constitutional. And personally, I took the view that while you have Section 9.1, which says that you have to give notice, and I held that that was a unnecessary restriction, because to give notice and you can't have an assembly, I'm talking about the organizer, you can't organize a spontaneous assembly, because a right to freedom of assembly should be without restriction, and there should be no time frame given on that. If people want to assemble later in the afternoon, they don't have. It's impossible to give 10 days notice. So the very right to have a spontaneous and peaceful assembly will be taken away if you insist on the organizer having to give 10 days notice. But having said that, I went further in my judgment to say that, well, even if we were to separate Section 9.1, which is a requirement for notice, and even if you say that the restriction is not unreasonable, then you don't need to have Section 9.5, which criminalizes the organizer for failing to give the 10 days notice. There are many other provisions in the Constitution, even, where you have to do certain things, but failure to do certain things doesn't make it an offense. So here, by making an offense to give the 10 days notice, I felt that this is ultra vires the Constitution, and the right to hold a spontaneous and free assembly becomes illusory with this requirement of 10 days. So that was how I looked at it. But I must, having said all that, I must add that another panel of the Court of Appeal came to an opposite decision. So we have two decisions on the same issue in the Court of Appeal.
Datuk Mao Ying-kwai, thank you very much for doing this.
Thank you. Indeed.
You've been listening to Human Rights Defenders, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.